Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 97-year-old Dwayne Harvey of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Henrietta, Oklahoma. He's one of the last surviving veterans of the 101st Airborne's 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment in World War II. Mr. Harvey told us how he volunteered to go overseas instead of a relatively safe job of training recruits stateside in Maryland. And then to become a paratrooper, of course, he had to volunteer again.
Well, that was one thing. Was in basic training, there was a kid from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He kept urging me, says, let's join the paratroopers. Let's join the paratroopers. I said, no, why? I'm satisfied. Then they were volunteers, and we knew what they were going to volunteer for. So I had an idea of what I was volunteering for.
And you mentioned Sobel was your jump instructor, and you also said you'd never been in a plane before, let alone jump out of a plane. So when you had to do those jumps to get certified as a paratrooper, were you anxious at all? Was that a little nerve-wracking as you prepared for that?
I was apprehensive, but so was everybody else, because we were all kids. There wasn't any older people there, let's say men. I was 18, and so were the others.
And had you heard any of the stories or read anything about the guys who jumped on D-Day and everything that happened to them?
Oh, no, because they were in Holland and on.
So they had jumped at D-Day. Now they're up at Operation Market Garden. And one of the reasons they needed replacements like you was the casualties they'd suffered.
Yes. So I kept wondering when we were going to go to Holland. Why were they keeping us here when they need men in Holland? Well, after the war sometime, I was reading why I realized then, come to find out, that the two divisions, 101st and 82nd, were under Montgomery's control. And naturally, with two divisions, he didn't want to turn them loose. When the Army, the U.S. Army, was saying, we need these troops back to replace them, he wouldn't release them because he wanted to keep control. So the two of them kept receiving casualties, and finally they said, you've got to release these so we can replace them. So that's when they came back. Then I realized, well, that's why they didn't send us up. If they kept replacing them, why, Montgomery was going to keep them.
I don't want to leave out anything that's important, but it sounds like we're getting to the point in your story where you're about to taste combat for the first time, and you're still a 19-year-old kid zeroing in on your 20th birthday when something that we all know about now was about to happen, but I'm sure you didn't know then that there's going to be this thing called the Battle of the Bulge. What was the lead up to that, and what did they do with you?
The morning of December the 18th, when we fell out for a morning roll call, the first sergeant called the roll and you had to answer. Well, generally, at that time, morning roll call, this platoon sergeant says, first platoon all present and counted for. And even though there was the men had gone into Reims on their own or into Paris and hadn't got back yet, then in fact they were AWOL, and he covered them up. But that morning, first sergeant called the roll, then he read the Articles of War on desertion and said, go eat breakfast, come back and pack your bags, dress warm, turn your bags into the supply room. So when, after breakfast, I came back. I had my cotton shorts and undershirt. So I put on my wool long johns, two pair of wool socks. I put on my wool GI pants, a shirt, wool sweater. I put on the combat pants and combat jacket. I had a wool scarf, my overcoat. Now, I was lucky, and I had a pair of overshoes, so I put them on. So that was December the 18th, and I wore those clothes. I had what passed for one shower until we got back in April on. But I, as I tell my kids, I don't ever remember being cold. Now, I did not have a rifle when we got on the trucks and pushed the trailers open and we stood up there.
They're trucking you from Marmalone to Bastogne, and You're layered up, prepared for the cold. I'm guessing a lot of the other guys standing up in the back of that flatbed truck aren't.
That's right. Some of them just had cotton, their cotton jumpsuits on. Well, the weather there that day wasn't, you know, when we left, wasn't that cold, so they didn't prepare. So they was a number of them, yes, were not equipped for the cold. But I followed orders, so I dressed warm.
And I'm sure you have some perspective now on how different things could have been if you didn't. But once you arrived in Bastogne, what did you find there? What are some of the things that you experienced over the days and weeks that followed?
Well, when we got there at night, or the night of December the 18th, around midnight, a place called Mandy Saint 18. So I laid down there on a bare spot and dozed. And the next morning, why, the 1st Battalion of the 501 was the one that led out. But I didn't have a weapon. There was a number of others. So the sergeant said, "Stay here till I send for you." So I stayed there and was wandering around the area where we got off the trucks. The artillery, the 907th glider artillery, was digging in a gun. And as I walked around, there was an M1 rifle laying there on the pile of dirt. And I reached down, picked it up. So I had a rifle and one clip of ammunition in it. Then that afternoon, a lieutenant came by and a jeep, got a number of us that was there on the jeep, and we went out to a dirt road south of Bastogne to set up a roadblock. And there was a tank there, and I went up to the tank and rapped on the side and asked if they had ammunition. He didn't have any in clips, but he had a box of 50 rounds, which he gave me. So I put those in my coat pocket, then went out on the road and started to scoop out a little place, which was night. And about midnight, we hadn't anything, so it was a Belgian blockhouse, so I went back. And then the next morning, we received an artillery barrage. And when the barrage was over, one of the other men came over and told me, said, "The lieutenant and Don Fair were killed." Now, I'd been in the Army a year by then, so I was kind of an old hand. But Don Fair had graduated from high school. He was an 18-year-old kid and volunteered, took his training, got to England. Well, he got, and then was shipped over to France, joined the 501st just a week or so before. So Don Fair was killed, never saw a German, never saw anyone, but died, and he's buried there in Epinal. Now, go forward, and when I was in Alsace, I'd been out on an observation post, and I came back, and the sergeant said, "Go back up, report to A Company. They're going on a raid tonight. You're to go with them." So I went up, and the Motor River swung across the valley and over against the German side, and there had rubber rafts. They gave me a plank to carry up, so they put across the rafts, because the Motor River was frozen with ice, but they didn't know if it'd support the troops, so they made that rubber raft bridge across the river. And all the time I was wondering, here they got to see us and know what we're doing, why aren't they firing at us? But there again, when the time came, I was going to go across that bridge. When it come my time to run, I was going to get up, I was going to run across that plank bridge on. But midnight, they gave us an artillery barrage. Then it went slacked off. Well, I went across, and the lieutenant there had six new replacements who had just came up to the front lines. And then once again, kids. Now, they were kids to me, and yet I was only 19. So he says, "Keep them back," because it was the first time they'd been in any kind of combat. So I strung them out in a line in the snow, and I told the first kid where the firefight was going on up ahead, I said, "Now you watch that man right there. And when he moves forward, you move forward. When he stops, you stop." So then I went back to each one of those kids and told them, I said, "You watch the boy in front of you, and you follow him." And then I got back so I wouldn't be leaving him behind. So this was in the snow and the woods and the trees and all the firing. Pretty soon the first kid come running back and yelling, "They're gone, they're gone, he's gone, he's gone. And I thought, oh, hell, because there was in there, got these six kids, got to join up with the others, and they're not going to know whether we're Germans or American. So went up and started yelling that we was coming in, we was Americans, friends, on, and we was coming into where they were. So I got them back in. We were coming back because it was morning. I come across the foxhole, took out three Germans out of the foxhole who'd knuckled down underneath there and stayed and let us go on by them, and was still there when we were coming back. So then I coming over, and they were carrying an American back. So I took the Germans and said, we'll take him. So three prisoners I had, well, we carried the fellow back across the river, the bridge, and when I got him to the first aid station, medic looked at him, says he's dead. So I took my prisoners, turned them back into the prisoner cage, and went back to headquarters. And when I got back there, well, they says, hurry up, we got a stand inspection. So what stand inspection? And Captain Howard came by, and he grabbed my rifle and looked at it and says, it's dirty. I said, well, I was on the raid last night. So he knew he had made a mistake and gave him a rifle back, but went on down the line. I never did like the Captain Howard. Number of years later, I was living in Wichita, and a fellow called me who was a sergeant in charge of the medics. He was in Wichita, and we pick up his daughter. We were talking about things, and I told him about carrying the wounded man back on the plank board that we'd picked up. And he says, they brought Gulick back on a board. So I learned that it was Gulick. Well, then I found out Gulick had jumped in Normandy. He had fought in Holland. He had fought in Bastogne. He was in Alsace. And when he got hit and was killed, that was the last battle combat we were in. So he had, from Normandy to the last hour, if he'd got through that night, why, maybe Gulick's still around. So I remember those two, Don Fair and Gulick, one who was killed the first time he was in combat with no experience, and then Gulick, who was killed the very last hour.
And I could tell you've given that some thought over the years, and I guess my follow-up would be, is there something that you draw from that? That contrast that you painted, the differing circumstances or the different experience leading up to their death, but the fact that they were both two who paid that ultimate price. What do you take away from what you just told me?
Well, here is one boy in high school and the war. He didn't survive there one bit of it. So what would his life have been? And here was Gulick, who did all this combat and was killed at the end of his fighting career. What would his life have been? I know what mine has been. But what would theirs have been?
And I'm so thankful you brought that up, because really, that's one of the biggest reasons I do this show, because there were 406,000 Americans who didn't come home from the war, and I'm sure you endured some close calls where it could have been you. When you think about those two today, how do you see your own life in relation to theirs?
Well, that I lived a life, that I survived that. So I married, raised a family, and on. They had no opportunities whatsoever to do anything other than fight a war.
More than 400,000 Americans made that ultimate sacrifice in World War II. And of course, we really do honor them and help keep their memory alive every time we recognize those who were fortunate enough to make it home. It's time for another break, but when we come back, more of Duane Harvey's memories from his days in the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment, including Bastogne during the worst of the Battle of the Bulge. Surrounded with dwindling supplies and no promise of help or rescue, how did he deal with that reality as he marked his 20th birthday amid that scenario? We're going to find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.